At KFC, everyday value meets big flavor. That means getting 6 crispy pieces of delicious dark meat drums and thighs, plus 4 biscuits, all for just $10 with our Dine and Dash deal. All that juicy, original recipe chicken for only 10 bucks every day. Now that's finger-lickin' good. Hurry into KFC and taste the deal we're cooking up. Limited time only. Prices and participation may vary. While supplies last, tax, tip, and fees extra. Not available on third-party ordering platforms.
At Emory University, we believe in those with the ambition to achieve, the passion to learn, and the optimism to see the possibilities ahead. Founded on a belief that the wise heart seeks knowledge, an Emory education combines experiential learning in Atlanta and beyond with unrivaled collaboration and discovery, all to prepare you for a world that needs your leadership. Learn more at emory.edu.
Good evening, everybody. Welcome to the Evangelical Dark Web. Tonight, we have a special guest, J.D. Hall, and I don't think he does too many interviews, but I don't have too many guests either, so it's a good time to have him on because, you know, he's someone who's been very instrumental in discernment polemics in general in the, in the age of social media and the internet, so this is a very good crossover to have in this day and age, and tonight, we're going to be discussing the religion of the post-war consensus and just trying to, getting a deeper dive on this issue, which I think is one of the, in some capacity, if you're doing a top five, threats to the church, I do think that this is something that has caused a malaise in Christianity over the last 80 some years. And it's also something that, has embedded some very dangerous practices and vain ideologies. So we're going to dive into that. But first, do like the stream and subscribe to the channel, to the podcast. If you're new, that's the best thing that you can do for the magical YouTube algorithms. I actually think likes work on live streams. I don't think they work on videos, but, definitely hit the like button for the live stream to get it out there. So with that said, how are you doing tonight?
I'm good. You?
How are you doing? It's a good day. It's a good day. Day job goes well. Then I can just do this and, things are good.
What is your day job?
I run a company. I won't necessarily disclose the details, but I own a company. It's the best at what it does in the country. And I'll leave it at that. So it's niche, best at what it does. And, I'm trying not to get certain people.
You don't want the Yelp reviews?
I do not want the Yelp reviews. I kind of want to keep it, down low what I actually do because, I'm not trying to get canceled. Not that you can really cancel me. I got very, very large customers that you have heard of. And I think, one of them's contractually obligated to do business with me. So, But the others, they're not going to find anyone new. So with that said... Yeah. I like being uncancelable and, you're someone who's pretty uncancelable as well because they've tried and you just, still exist. And
I've definitely been canceled a bunch of times. It's just that, it's like the Michael Scott paper company, you got lots of names. you just keep coming back. So that's the beauty of it. I talk about that a lot at Insight to Insight. And it's something that's very, it's noticeable, but it's very powerful. And it's part of what I call the populist social revival. It's one of the things that have really instrumentally changed evangelicalism because after, the Christian book industry really monopolized in the 1950s, the Billy Graham Evangelistic Association and all of that, they took over Christianity Today or started it. It always was that. But they took over the whole, industry. And so you couldn't find a contrary voice in evangelicalism, in book, in radio, in television. And then with the internet came polemics and discernment. And finally, if a pastor didn't like what was being produced in, say, the Sunday school quarterly, he had a voice, right? But there was still a lot of gatekeeping that has gone on. But in the last, I'd say, 5 years or so, that, you know, the gatekeepers are practically all dead. You know, they're everyone has a platform. You have access to how many billions of people on X. You can't take someone's platform from them. And I mean, I guess, you know, they did that with Trump, right? But for the most part, everybody's uncancelable. The problem is today people are canceling themselves, and it's sad to see.
Yeah, I always kind of figured it's like you only can get, well, I mean, they go after the weak links, which might not even be your own personal fortitude, but just the people that you interact with and stuff like that to get you canceled. But a lot of the people who were, you know, I feel like a lot of the people who got canceled were canceled because they were weak. They apologized, and it's like they apologized to the woke mob, and that just, you know, that's because they knew you would do that is why you got canceled. Like Phil Robertson didn't apologize, and you know, that actually made him less cancelable, would be the counter example to that.
Yeah. So it's, chum in the water, and it's basically shaming people into silence. And I think that that's really dead. That's really dead.
Yeah. And you had a comeback in 2024, which I thought was very welcome, but you got to forgive me because I was kind of unfamiliar with how based you were and are. And when you came back, and it's like, I did not exactly expect you to be like a noticer and all these other things like that. So I'm kind of curious as to how your views developed on that. And, you know, is there a relation to that? And, you know, part of your start, as I understand it, because I had watched, I've been like a protester pulpit and pen reader since like 2019. Onward now. So, I didn't exactly, you know, get all the dissent right, new Christian right talking point, or I didn't necessarily see that. I'm not surprised in hindsight, but I didn't necessarily, you know, pick up on that. Like some of us, you know, have kind of believed, a lot of the right wing stuff. I'm not trying to be reductionist about it, but we had these right-wing views for like a long time. It's just, you know, how do we, and how it particularly plays out in government, I guess, is different. So I guess, you know, long question short, how exactly, you know, how did you become based?
So, you know, I didn't know what that was. I looked it up in 2024. So I went almost 2 years without even reading Protestia or looking online or reading polemics. I just focused on, you know, me and surviving day by day. And, you know, life got really hard. And so I didn't need any of that in my life. And so the day Trump was almost assassinated, I thought, I've got to get on X and see what is the real news all of a sudden, because I knew that's where it would be. And I get on X. And I look, it blew my mind. So much has changed in that 2 years. Now it's 3 years, but it's absolutely incredible. And I by that, I mean in the evangelical online world in particular, and even more narrow, that online evangelical world on X, where I felt like for so long, I was like the only guy. And I know there were plenty more, but it felt like I was the only guy just saying what I wanted to say. And everyone else is walking on eggshells all the time. Like, I remember, so Jackie Hill Perry said, the gospel is not the exclusive property of rich old white men. And so I responded, this was like in 2020, maybe 2019. I don't know. I said, the gospel is not the exclusive property of militant butch black women. Right. And I'm sure I probably tweeted it while I was driving, you know, I didn't put any thought into it. And then there was this monumental avalanche of crap coming my way of just being, it was canceled, for lack of a better word, by all the people that had tried to cancel me so many times before, like, what's new? But, you know, at SBC Voices, they did a blog, probably the third or fourth one on this topic, but it was why we should all get together and boycott pulpit and pen, because JD called Jackie Hill Perry a militant butch, you know, black woman. And I'm like, I'm saying to myself, what's not true about any of that? she's militant. She's butch. I mean, she did a spoken word about trying to peace standing up. She wrote a spoken word called My Life as a Stud about being a masculine lesbian. And obviously she's a Black woman. Here's the thing. Here's my point. Today, if you said something like that, no one would bat an eye. They'd be like, it's just another day on X. So I was saying things and just getting pummeled because nobody else that was, you know, notable in our little tiny niche of evangelicalism was saying anything similar. So I show up on X and it's like, dude, I almost cried. Like, for real. Like, it made me emotional. Like, what happened? Everybody's free all of a sudden. Everybody's just saying whatever it is that they want to say. So on one hand, it was a little bit scary, like Lord of the Flies. Like, what's happening here? Where are the adults? No one's in charge. You know, there's pig heads on stakes, you know, and the natives have gone off the reservation. But on the other hand, it was beautiful to see because everyone's just saying the things they want to say. And now we can have a real discussion, because if everyone's walking on eggshells all the time, having to be governed by the rules of evangelical correctness, then we can't have serious conversations about anything.
Now, there is definitely a push to tone police and pearl clutch. I think that is, you know, you're seeing a huge campaign for pearl clutching right now. That's especially going on against like Joel Webbin, and, you know, Doug Wilson and stuff like that. You got Gavin Ortland, who, yeah, I think it's tomorrow's or maybe today's Russell Moore. Like, Russell, like you were calling out Russell Moore. It's like, you know, the guy now has an apprentice named Gavin Ortland. So it's like that I think will be the discernment test, because, you know, calling out Russell Moore before it was cool, you know,
that was in 2013. I called out Russell Moore and I said, the guy is a closet Democrat. He is a progressive liberal. And I was immediately contacted by Frank Turk of Pyromaniacs, you know, the conservative blog, yeah. You know, belonging to Phil Johnson and so forth.
Yeah.
And the other guy, the three.
You said Frank Turek?
Frank okay. Turek. Okay. He's kind of retired as a blogger, but he says, I still remember, I was, TMI, I was in the bathtub talking to Frank Turk, and he's saying, you're going to ruin yourself. He's a Calvinist. Calvinists cannot be liberals, JD. They can't. Like, it's like, that was kryptonite. He's one of us. Like, he has been endorsed by Albert Mohler. Clearly he's not. But I'm like, you know, I called it how I saw it. And so it wasn't like people didn't listen to me on Russell Moore for a year or two. It was dang near 7-8 years. And I saw William, I still don't know everybody's name. Wolf.
William Wolf
said the other day on X that now anywhere he goes, he mentions Russell Moore and people are booing. You got to remember, there was a time when not only would it have been unpopular to you know, besmirch the great name of Russell Moore, it would have been considered unfathomable that anyone would do that, even though the evidence was all right there. So we've come a long way. And I wrote a lot about this in that first big article that I did about where I've been and our story and the things that we've gone through. And I said that that's been one of the biggest things, I think, that have changed since I was away for a while, in that for the longest time at Protestia and before that Pulpit and Pen, what we did was to lay out the battle lines. Good guys, bad guys, maybe a little bit simplistic, a little bit too black and white, but who's on what side? But as it stands right now, the battle lines are drawn. We know what side somebody's on. It's very clear what side, for the most part, people are on in this cosmic battle of good and evil. We know, but back then, nobody was calling anybody out. So unless, you know, you would have Phil Johnson call out Rob Bell, or John Piper call out Rob Bell. But I remember in 2015, I think it was, maybe early 2016, Phil Johnson accused Tabiti Anabwile of mission drift. And that turned into a big, huge ordeal, because that was the first time someone prominent critiqued someone associated with the Gospel Coalition. That was seismic. People were freaking out. Like, what's happening in evangelicalism? Someone's challenging the Gospel Coalition, guys? And so that's how far we've come. So I think there's a lot of younger guys who maybe have come of age in one way or another in maturity in the last, say, 5 years. They don't understand the scars and the battles that we old guys went through to get us to this point, where that was unfathomable. The 11th commandment, which, depending upon the conversation, is, you know, different for the conversation. Like, if you're a Southern Baptist, the 11th commandment is thou shalt not criticize Southern Baptists, right? So whoever you are, that 11th commandment is basically be nice all the time. That really wasn't broke. It was called the 11th commandment for a reason. That was a rule. You don't criticize someone who's on your side. And so to stand up and say, Russell Moore's not on our side, or how about this one? Albert Mueller's not on our side. That was so unpopular, even 3 or 4 years ago, we forget what it was like. And everybody that's out there throwing elbows and taking punches right now should be really thankful that we have the freedom to do that without being instantly anathematized, you know, for some breach of decorum.
Yeah. And people like to, you know, decry the rise of social media, but I actually think it's been a blessing to the church, and specifically the, you know, democratization of information, so that you don't have to rely on three channels or newspapers and all that, let alone, you know, apply that to the church, where you mean you don't have to rely on Gospel Coalition email list, newsletters and all right. that other stuff.
Yeah.
This is huge. And, you know, I think it's going to contribute to the, you know, fall of dispensationalism, because, you know, people are only taught one theology or one eschatology, but now they can look at other theologies that existed. But it does pair with the rise of Reformed theology, I think, as well. Like, Calvinism definitely seems reascendant, especially when you look at, like, 100 years ago, the Southern Baptist Convention was anti-Calvinist, despite the fact that they were founded pretty much exclusively by Calvinists, as I understand it.
Right. So, you know, in the beginning, you have Basil Manley Jr. and Sr. You've got John Dagg. You've got James Pettigrew Boyce. The founders were all, you know, Calvinists. But by 1923, that's over. That was done. By 1963, with Herschel Hobbes, it was long dead. Like, it was room temperature. And, you know, when Roe v. Wade was passed in 1973, the Southern Baptist Convention endorsed it. They passed a resolution endorsing Roe v. Wade. And so you have the conservative resurgence that happened in the 1980s. By 1990, it was pretty well smoothed over, where we thought that we had run the liberals out. It started with Adrian Rogers, the pastor of Bellevue Baptist Church in Memphis. And you had these great sermons, you know, by various leaders like Jerry Vines and Billy Baptist and his Bible. And we thought we drove the liberals out. That was what I heard growing up. We kicked the liberals out. Turns out we didn't. You had a great many sign the Confession of Faith. They signed the Baptist Faith and Message, say, 2000 or 1963. They said they agreed with it, but it was only 3 or 4 years ago that I was smoking foxes out of the holes at, say, Southwest Baptist University in Missouri, where the dean of the religious school at that Southern Baptist college was an annihilationist, didn't even believe in hell. So these guys went underground because liberals will lie about who they are in order to maintain their influence.
Yeah, I mean, why wouldn't a false teacher lie?
Right. And that's what J. Gresham Machen taught us, is that you know, in institutions, these guys go undercover. Then you have people that for a time really did adopt a conservative ideology. When Albert Mueller first came on the scene, he was an egalitarian, full-blown liberal egalitarian. Next thing you know, he's offered the keys to Southern Seminary, and he kicks out all of the Arminians. He says you have to sign on to the abstract of principles if you're going to work at Southern. He took on this sort of the crown of conservatism in the SBC. And then it was about 2011, 2012, we started noticing that he was changing. And all of a sudden, matter of fact, one time I was in a car with Tom Nettles, long-serving professor at Southern Seminary. And Nettles said something to me like, look who he's hiring. He was telling me something was up. I didn't know what. And I look into it, and all of a sudden, he's hiring all these non-Calvinists at Southern all of a sudden. And this is completely under the radar of most Southern Baptists. They're not seeing it. And he had made one comment about the abstract of principles being a three-point document. And I'm talking about the 5 points of Calvinism. Well, that's absurd. But all of a sudden, Mohler says it's a three-point document. And then the next thing you know, well, you've got Karen Swallow Pryor invited to speak at the Fuller School, you know, the Fuller Center at Southern, and Sho Baraka singing in the chapel, and all this, you know, horrendous crap being done. And so there are chameleons that just change back and forth. But here's why I went on that rant. On the Calvinism issue, what I really think happened is that in 2006, I think it was 2006, you have the guy at Christianity Today write the article. He's at Christianity Today, but I think he wrote it for Time or Newsweek, 10 ideas that are changing the world or whatever. And it was on new Calvinism. And from that point forward, it was cool to be a Calvinist. Colin Hansen, that's who it was. It was cool to be a Calvinist. And I think that there were demonic forces. I think literally like the powers and principalities of darkness in high places, and globalists and Marxists saw that Calvinism was kind of this organic trend growing in evangelicalism. They jumped on that. And like, as Frank Turk told me, no Calvinist can be a liberal. It was the perfect Trojan horse. The Gospel Coalition, all those guys claim to be Calvinists. I mean, if I were to ask you, say, hey, tell me who's the darkest figure in evangelicalism in the last 30 years? Like, if this was Star Wars, who's the emperor? Who is the liberal? Like, so patently obvious, wolf in sheep's clothing. You'd probably say Tim Keller, right? It's hard to imagine.
What's his face? Kevin Ezell, the Phantom Menace of the Southern Baptist Convention.
Dark Maul, maybe. I'd say Tim Keller. So you have these guys that are, Calvinism is their badge, can't possibly be a liberal. And who brought social justice into evangelicalism?
That was Keller. It was
these new Calvinists down the line, every last one of them. And so, you know, that's what we did at Pulpit.
Right. So he's glitching up a little bit. So, yeah, and I think that's very true. What he's saying is that, you know, Calvinism was used as a Trojan horse to introduce people who were very bad at theology. And one thing that comes to mind is that this had to do with Woke Wars 1. As we're fighting Woke Wars 1, a lot of the people who were on both sides of that issue were largely Calvinist. And you get very few people on both sides of that issue, as far as I can remember, that didn't claim to be Calvinist on either side of that issue. You maybe have some people like Jack Hibbs, not a Calvinist, and, you know, they didn't bend the knee to wokeness and stuff like that, at least on, you know, the issue of race. So, see if JD is going to come back anytime soon. Okay, so he is not. So I find that to be very fascinating, and we're going to get to the post-war consensus part when we get back. But then we have the whole issue of the Woke Wars 1 and going into Woke Wars 2. And I've said this before, and I'll say it again. What happened in Woke Wars 1 was we kind of, you know, we were trying to fight back against what was really a long march through the institutions in evangelicalism, and Woke Wars 2 was
really just a reshuffling of the deck when it comes to the leadership in the church, in the, you know, greater scheme of evangelicalism. There's some people who are in charge of a small island of evangelicals that really just are interested in their turf. They're just interested in their small domain, whereas there's a much bigger picture at work, and some people see the bigger picture, some people don't see the bigger picture. And one thing that I found to be very inspirational for how to really just fight this battle is JD's work on the Protestant Manifesto and how he talked about just not being used. And I thought that was very useful and aspirational as far as how we should conduct ourselves in this battle. But what happened before JD came back to social media in 2024 was the shakeout of Woke Wars 2, where there was a split even among the people that were on the right side of the issue in Woke Wars 1. There was a split where...
At KFC, everyday value meets big flavor. That means getting 6 crispy pieces of delicious dark meat drums and thighs, plus 4 biscuits, all for just $10 with our Dine and Dash deal. All that juicy, original recipe chicken for only $10 every day. Now that's finger-licking good. Hurry into KFC and taste the deal we're cooking up. Limited time only. Prices and participation may vary. While supplies last, tax, tip, and fees extra. Not available on third-party ordering platforms.
Because, you know, the same people that were fought against, you know, critical race theory did not... It was a division on whether to go at the source. You know, where did critical race theory come from? And why are we treating certain groups as victims? Why are we showing partiality for false religions and stuff like that? And part of the issue of where that arises is the post-war consensus seems to be one of the driving factors of the divide that divides Woke Wars 2. Now, a big debate going on right now is the Declaration of Independence. And a lot of people are discussing the Declaration of Independence right now, but it, you know, the Babylon Bee people. And what they don't realize is that, you know, there's more than just one sentence, you know, we hold these truths to be self-evident that all men are created equal and dot, dot, dot. So I always find it weird that, you know, the Proposition Nation bros, first of all, forget the subject of the sentence is we, and they didn't read the rest of the Declaration of Independence that clearly acknowledges that we're a specific people with ties that are kindred to the British people and the mainland. So while you're gone, I'm just explaining, you know, how Woke Wars 1 transitioned to Woke Wars 2. And Woke Wars 2, I think that one, you know, there's two things that have really been the dividing line. One is the Proposition Nation, because people read one line in the Declaration of Independence, didn't read the rest of it, didn't really read the Founding Fathers and what they wrote, or, you know, Naturalization Act of 1790, stuff like that. And the other is the post-war consensus. I think these are kind of like the two issues that are kind of dividing, you know, the Antioch Declaration crowd and the, you know, the Christian right crowd. Is that your read of the situation?
Yeah, I don't think people understand how deep the post-war consensus goes. And so one of the essential things that you have to do if you're contending in the realm of ideas is to trace the origin of ideas. Where does this idea go back to? Like during the social justice days, during the Dallas Statement, I was giving lectures all around the country from a series that I did called The Poison Tree, where I'm tracing all of these various ideas in social justice actually back to Karl Marx, who was not an atheist. He was a Satanist. And so it's very important to do. Well, all of these ideas that we as conservative evangelicals, including the Antioch crowd, the Antioch Statement people, many of these terrible ideas that we're trying to dispute come directly from the post-war consensus indoctrination that we have received in everything from our culture to media to the public school system. And so you have guys that pride themselves on not being indoctrinated, not being carried away captive, to vain philosophy and empty conceit, deceit. And yet they're espousing these concepts that came to us through the post-war consensus that are absolutely killing us. I'll just give one example. You have conservative evangelicals that don't believe in open borders. They might be okay with, you know, HB1 visas. They might, you know, they might be okay with certain kinds of, you know, the guys that say, I don't mind immigration as long as it's legal, but they understand it's not good to flood the United States with the third world. Okay, their head is on at least that straight. But they don't comprehend that the notion of flooding our nation with the third world comes from this concept called the open societies. Open societies, and if you hear the term open society,
George Soros comes to mind.
If you pay attention to the news, yeah, you're thinking of George Soros, the Open Societies Foundation. The open societies is the name of an ideology that came straight up out of the post-war consensus. And it's free trade. It's treating every nation just as an economic zone. Basically, it is the end of nationalism altogether. And so they're actually embracing this notion of open societies in so many different ways, not understanding that's why you have runaway immigration. So I don't think the typical conservative evangelical understands the origin of a lot of the very ideas that we recognize on some level are bad, that we need to defeat or dispute, are actually part of that indoctrination. And, you know, the expression is it's easier to fool a man than to convince a man that he's been fooled.
Right.
Right. It's easier to indoctrinate a man than it is to convince him that he's been indoctrinated. And so, I think younger people are understanding. They're more open to understanding the origin of these bad ideas that came from the post-war consensus than, say, for example, a boomer. And I don't want to be disrespectful to the old, you know, to our elders. I'm not one that's just going to sit here and bash the quote unquote boomers all day long. But you'll notice a huge generational divide if you were to criticize, say, for example, Winston Churchill.
I had a question.
Like, they will absolutely flat lose their...
Yeah, I've seen that in person, not among boomers, though. I'm like a history buff. You know, it's what I watch on YouTube a lot and stuff like that. And, you know, one thing that's just very true in, you know, with World War II is, like, yeah, most of Europe was, like, very worse off from the Allies, you know. You know, they didn't benefit from the Allies winning. Like, obviously, Eastern Europe, we all know that those people were worse off from the Allies winning. The British Empire was then destroyed. Can't really say that they were better off. Germany and Italy were not better off, obviously. So, you know, which countries really benefited? Obviously, the United States did geopolitically, and the Soviet Union did. Like, they were, you know, geopolitically and all that, they were the winners of World War II. And then Mao in China, I guess, was able to capitalize over the Nationalist Party.
Yeah. I don't get to spend that much time on X. But, like, I'll log on a couple of times a day, so I kind of lose track of some discussions and threads sometimes. But there was
This is like me acknowledging this without social media. It's like, man, who actually benefited? Like, who actually came out on top here? But
there was a guy on my X who took issue with what I had said about the UK being utterly lost. So my point was the UK, my tweet said something like the UK did not learn the lessons it should have from the war. And it's lost. So because they adopted the open society's ideology, like, short of a mass deportation,
And that's, you know, that could cause us, you know, the people are brewing for rebellion in the UK right now.
Wow. It's like it's the notion of being British is in one generation. It's not hyperbole to say the England is gone. Yeah. And I said, you know, looking around now, my point was, since 50 years before Christ, Englishmen have been defeating invasion after invasion after invasion.
Yeah, the only one that succeeded was William the Conqueror.
Well, they defeated, or at least pushed back the Romans. So they've been successful, but now they've been invaded in this weird reverse crusade where they actually invite the conquistadors to come invade, and they've absolutely taken over. Anyways, point is, someone said on the thread, are you saying that it would have been better had Hitler won? No, I am saying, you know, maybe we could have a discussion as to whether or not the war was necessary to begin with, or if the war was necessary, if it was ever necessary to become a world war. My point is, though, very simple. Look at Europe today and tell me if it's not worse than anyone in 1945 would have thought it could have been had the Axis powers won. In other words, what I'm saying is, if you were to go ask your typical Frenchman or Englishman in 1944, hey, if the Axis powers win, I want you to put together in your head the notion of what life will be like. I don't think they would have come up with something truly as bad as what most of Europe.
Well, Amazon made Man in the High Castle, which presupposed Germany taking over the United States and splitting with the Japanese, and they made a super clean society. That's like, what?
Right. You've got Poland and Hungary and some bright places, but for the most part, I mean, it's trashed. Yeah. And so the reason why we go back and look at history is, it's not for the sake of revisionism, as one boomer told me recently. We're not trying to revision history. We're trying to separate actual history from mid-war propaganda. We've all heard the expression that the victors write the history books. But do you know who said it? Winston Churchill. And guess what? He ended his life as a politician and started writing history books. He was a renowned historian. And a legit historian. Not that his history is legit, but he could do historiography. I read so much of his work when I was getting my master's degree in history. Point is, Churchill took the narrative that he was pushing as the prime minister and before that, long before that, from World War I onwards, and then he put that in the history books, and that's what we have, and that's what we have in school, right? So the notion of the victors writing the history books, that's true. And it's ironic that it comes from Churchill. And so we have to separate history from propaganda if we're to come to the right conclusions. Let me give you one brief example of that. World War II was largely caused by the treatment of Germany after World War I. And the treatment of Germany was so bad that it actually caught, without getting into the details, it was so vindictive that it actually caused a rift between the United States and the UK. Like, it made Americans uncomfortable exactly how hard Germany got the shaft on the part of the UK. And so you have the German people who are suffering vindictively, punitively, for how they felt that the negotiation at the end of World War I left things kind of shoved down their throat, that nobody was caring about them. Their nationalistic concerns were no concerns at all. You've got the Weimar Republic, and which it was just abusive to its own people. You've got all of these various...
they made Czechoslovakia, but gave, the Czechs all the power, and it was just a failed state.
You've got the German people being run roughshod. No one treated them as human beings, essentially. Here comes a guy who says, you are important. I do care about your survival. Screw everybody else. I care about the German people. That's Hitler. After World War II, immediately after, to their credit, the Allies learned the lesson from World War I, and they said, we're not doing that again. So despite everything that Germany had done. What did we do? The Allied powers rebuilt Germany. They gave them a legitimate olive branch. They reached out with a hand of friendship. We welcomed them into the international community. We did not exile and exclude them. Ditto for Japan. And man, so Japan, it was to worse. The Allies. Much worse. And we learned the lesson of World War One, and because of that, we were able to have lasting peace with Germany after World War II. Okay. So that being the case, over time, largely because of the post-war consensus, because we couldn't be factual about what caused that war and what the problem was. The post-war consensus is putting the blame on strong national leadership, on nationalism in general.
And just to interject, I was in AP US history. They taught, you know, World War, you know, the main causes of World War One, and you know, they blame nationalism for World War One.
Well, that's exactly right. Okay. And so the lesson, I would encourage you to read the book, Return of the Strong Gods, that can help explain this concept to you. Point is, the lesson that we learned after World War One that helped us build an international community shortly after World War II disappeared. Because we're getting dishonest in the history books, we can't say what really caused World War One anymore. We stopped learning that lesson.
Yeah, we also act like German unification wasn't an ongoing hundreds of years, you know, German movement as well.
Yeah, our history is very simplistic, especially when it comes to European countries and where those boundaries are. Point is, after in 1990, the Berlin Wall comes down, the Soviet Union disbands. If we had learned the lesson from World War One and World War II, how it unfolded, it went the wrong way. We made the right decisions towards Germany, and then it went the right way. We would have disbanded NATO. We would have taken our foot off the throat of Russia. We would have said, you do have a right to care about your national interests. We don't want to have you in a position of perpetual servitude. We want to treat you as equals, you know, and not as though we would, you know, let Russia rebuild its nuclear arsenal or anything like that. But we would not have done what we did, which is effectively not in
the and then just laugh at the idea of Russia ever being an ally. Like, you know, Putin basically said he got laughed at.
The Soviet Union disbands, and then we add more nations to NATO. We build up NATO's military capacity even more. When the war's over, like the Cold War's done, and what do? Well, we do everything possible to agitate Russia. We treat Russia after the end of the Cold War the same way that Germany was treated after the end of World War One. The next thing we know, we have a dictator invading the nation next door. And it's like history is repeating itself. And so, you've got the invasion of Ukraine caused because Kamala Harris goes over to Ukraine.
Promises NATO.
And right. So, you know, hopefully your listeners know the story. So we're remaking those same mistakes instead of learning the lessons. And that's why the post-war consensus is important, because I think a lot of people don't understand, why are you guys talking about the post-war consensus? It's not about how many Jews died in the Holocaust. It's really not. We're not talking about, was Hitler the good guy and Churchill the bad guy? Let's just get rid of all the bull crap, all the propaganda. Let's learn the lessons that we need to learn, because if we don't learn the lessons that we need to learn from World War II, we're going to have a World War III. And in World War III, that's the end of the world. Can we be honest? I mean, short of an eschatological plan of God that does not involve a nuclear apocalypse, that's exactly where we're headed if we can't learn the lessons. And so when you've got a bunch of 60-year-olds and 70-year-olds and 80-year-olds who have been given this religion, essentially, it's got all of the various marks and characteristics of religion.
Right. Just to expound on that.
If they will not let go of this, we're going to repeat the same problems, only this time we're not talking about, tanks and World War II crop dusters. We're talking about 12,000 nuclear warheads between two countries.
And then millions of drones.
Yeah, right. Yeah.
So
those are the lessons we have to learn.
So what makes it a religion exactly? Other than the devotion to it. I think that is by far the biggest sign that it's a religion is, you know, if you question mud, you know, part of it is, you know, democracy is good and, you know, any sort of autocratic government is bad. You know, nationalism is bad. You can't have nations because of a man with a mustache in, you know, 1930s and 40s. Right. What are some other, you know, those are some of the key beliefs. What are the more religious aspects of it?
Let me go through those and I'll get to the religious aspects, but let me just say this from polemics, because I think most of your listeners will understand this concept. At Protestia and Pulpit and Pen, I said so many times over the years, if you want to know if something has become an idol to someone, just touch it. That's all you need to do. How they respond will tell you whether it's an idol or not, because anything can become one if it's our level of devotion to it that will determine whether it's an idol or not. So for example, I had a lady in my church who was not an iconoclast. I am an iconoclast. I don't believe in images of Christ. And she was telling me how she has these images of Jesus. She does not pray to them. They are not idols to her in her heart. She doesn't have any idolistic tendencies whatsoever. It just, when she sees them, she thinks about Jesus, and then that makes her pray to Jesus. I was having a Bible study at her house one time, and so out of curiosity, I turned a Precious Moments type Jesus figurine around. I moved it on the shelf, and she lost her ever-loving mind. I mean, she had a conniption fit that her Jesus was touched. Why? Because it was an idol. That's how you know it's not just a harmless image. It has a place in their heart of affection and esteem that has become a thing of religious devotion. And when you say something along the lines of, you know, Churchill committed his share of war crimes, and people come unglued like Owen Strand.
Yeah. Or and I'll just, you know, I say more along the lines, yeah, the British were worse off having fought World War II. It's like, don't you think that they would have been invaded? And like, who is going to invade? Who is going to cross the English Channel? Yeah. Like, no one's ever thought about the like, you know, if you're doing a power rankings of World War II powers, British is at the number one, France number two, Russia three. Germany, at best, is the fourth most powerful nation in 1939. And they took on the top three.
I think, to me, in terms of moral clarity, to me, I think it's so obvious it should go without saying that the nuclear bombing of Nagasaki was not just a war crime. It was an abomination in every conceivable way. We bombed the only Christian community in Asia, the only one. And almost everything that you've learned about that bombing is total crap. All right. The projections were not a million dead soldiers. You've got the Eisenhower and MacArthur and the leaders of the Allied troops forces in the Pacific theater, all of them saying that was unnecessary. It didn't need to be invaded at all. You've got the first bomb already having dropped. We dropped it on American POWs. Like, we had American POWs that we turned to glass. Yeah. Nagasaki was not a place of significant strategic military importance whatsoever.
The only thing strategic about it was the only place that was, other than, you know, Hiroshima was like reserved, and it was a more industrial place.
It had some shipbuilding, but we were already dropping conventional bombs all over Japan. It's the ports were, I think it was like running at 10% capacity, but we didn't hit that. We did not hit that. We hit a church that was ground zero in the residential part of Nagasaki. We didn't hit their shipbuilding facility. The whole thing is just tragic beyond tragic. The Japanese were reaching out to Russia, trying to surrender. And it wasn't an unconditional surrender. They wanted to keep
that's a condition, by the way, for those who are not aware. Like, even America accepted that condition.
Well,
we use the term unconditional surrender, but, you know, Japan's surrender was conditional.
They said, we want to keep the emperor. So we nuked them. We nuked them twice. And by the time it was done, the Allied forces let Japan keep the emperor. So it's a matter of absolute demonstrable fact that it actually accomplished nothing. Nothing. But for 1700 years, 1600 years, you've got the Christian church in the West operating under Augustine's just war theory that would say that was abominable and about five or six different reasons. Just nuts. Here's my point, though. If I said that, right, you're going to have people come unglued, super mad that's your opinion. Like, it's beyond being unpatriotic. And they would treat you like, would legitimately, just like a heretic, okay? That you have spoken something that has actually condemned you, in the same way that if, as a Christian, you had somebody stand up in church and say, I don't believe in God the Father, Son, and Holy Ghost. I don't believe that they are three persons. I think that they're one person in different modes. You know, say they're espousing modalism or monarchianism or Sabellianism. You'd hear this gasp, and everyone who's Orthodox would go, I can't believe that you would say that. Why are you even, what's wrong with you? And it's like, if that's your theory, hey, maybe we shouldn't have nuked a bunch of babies in Japan.
And it's the same reaction.
Okay, so there's that. So that being said, here are the similarities. First of all, just like with any religion, there are creeds and dogma of the post-war consensus. Just as in Christianity, you have these core tenets, these basic doctrines, and we would say, you can't be a Christian if you don't hold to these doctrines. So we would have the Trinity, for example. You would have the incommunicable attributes of God, like his omniscience and his omnipresence and his omnibenevolence. You've got all of these characteristics of God that we would say, if you don't believe in these things, you're not a Christian. The post-war consensus has its own core doctrines and tenets. So one of those would be free trade. It is no more tariffs. Trade is open and free. As a matter of fact, the less border that a nation has, the better. And from that developed all of these international agencies, and the United Nations is, you know, just a start. People don't understand that these international governing bodies, even things like the WEF or the WHO, these are things that would have been out of place and never considered before the post-war consensus. But now the idea is strong national leaders like Mussolini and Hitler caused World War II, right? It wasn't the way Germany was treated, because that would put blame on the good guys. So it's Hitler bad. And so because of that, we need to have the entire world ruled, governed essentially by these bureaucratic organizations and boards. You have democracy as definitely an idol, that democracy is the be-all end-all of human existence. And so if necessary, we will fight wars against sovereign nations. And by the way, how dare they be sovereign? Say, for example, in the Middle East or in Asia, we will go to war with sovereign nations to make them democratic, because it is something that they have to do, right? So it's almost like it's an essential human right, like breathing. If necessary, we will assassinate the leaders of those sovereign nations. We will instigate coups, and we will overthrow sovereign nations in order to make them democratic. And then, you know, over the last 20 years, even the definition of democracy itself has changed, to where democracy is not really people voting per se. So, you know, you take a nation like Ukraine, which doesn't have an elected president right now. And you'd say, well, how's that democratic, right? Democracy.
I know, because here's the thing. Evolved. He could totally, because, you know, Ukraine's not overly honest about how, you know, casualties. He could totally just flood the ballot, you know, like a certain president in the United States did with a bunch of people on the front lines and win the claim victory in the election. He could totally do that.
Well,
he could pull
in the last. He could, yeah. I don't think people understand what's going on in Ukraine at all. It's very
it is frustrating because it's like, and part of it goes back to, they don't know what a nation is, and that, you know, in the Russian mind, you know, those are ethnic Russians and therefore they have a duty. Moscow sees itself as the protector of the Russian people.
Right. Well, you've got people in Eastern Ukraine who really are Russian. They speak Russian. They practice the Russian Orthodox faith. And, you know, you've got Zelensky, who we're going all over the map now tonight, brother. But you've got Zelensky, who's actually engaging in what the United Nations calls definitionally ethnic cleansing, which he's actually, this started before Zelensky, actually, in 2014, where they're burning the books in the Russian language in libraries and confiscating them from schools.
Yeah, they passed language laws. And even Zelensky himself was a native Russian speaker. Like, he was not a native Ukrainian speaker.
The United States State Department had to orchestrate effectively their own January 6th, a coup d'etat in 2014, because the Ukrainian government was to pro-Russia.
They were voting on a bailout. You know, they're, you know, having a bid, you know, the EU is bidding and Russia was bidding for a bailout, you know, like the Greeks were getting regularly back then. And Russia won on the 11th hour, bidding for a bailout, which would not have helped their economy at all. But, you know, just following that post-war consensus economic,
but
Keynesian economics.
Post-war consensus evolves, and so in the last 10 years, the definition of democracy has been basically the agreement or consensus of institutions. So it's not even necessarily individual people voting. It's about institutions like the academy, like trade unions.
And going back to the UK, great example, because they voted for Brexit. What did they get? Open borders invasion.
Yeah. And that's okay. So when I say dogma, I'm referring essentially to the term open societies. If you don't know what I'm talking about, just please Google it, research it, understand where that term came from. The idea is if nation is blood and soil, people will die for that. And so after World War II, they're looking at millions and millions dead, right? And I don't mean figuratively. They're literally looking at millions, and the corpses are still on the battlefield. You know, they're absolutely everywhere. Every family has lost someone because of the war. Well, the thought process among the thought leaders was, we need to make it so that no one is willing to die ever again.
Yeah, John Lennon's Imagine.
That's exactly right. That's basically the anthem of open society. So I would die for blood and I would die for soil, but I'm not going to die for an idea. I'm not going to die for something that is intangible and untouchable, but I'll sure as heck die for my people and for where I'm from. So a nation can no longer be defined that way. And one sure way of doing that is to root up people from where they are, send them to go live somewhere else, tear down the border, get away from... You know, why do you even need a passport? So you have the development of the United Nations. You have all of the free trade agreements where a nation is and you see them brag about this in Western Europe, where it's like, this side of the street is this country. That side of the street is that country. And we just go back and forth. And I can be on a train here and go through, you know, three countries by 5 o'clock tonight. That's the goal. But the purpose behind it is actually quite sinister. The purpose of third world migration is not to mass migration, is not to better the lives of people in the third world. Okay. If the goal was to better their lives, we would actually go there and do things that would actually better their lives. We would go colonize them, basically. That's what we can do.
Because Mr. Beast digging wells just is not good enough, because the concept of maintenance doesn't exist.
Right. It is so that you flood London with so many Pakistanis that you have somebody not feel like it's really London. That's how you get people not to not die for their country. So open societies is sort of like it's creed and dogma, but you also have you have your high priests and hierarchy. So you no longer have a Hitler and a Mussolini, but you've got the United Nations, the European Union, you've got all these various little bureaucratic organizations with incredible power, but they're not even really elected. It's the bureaucratic class that runs the world. And if a leader does rise up and show actual strong leadership, we're going to compare him to Hitler. Can you think of any examples? Let's say, for example, a leader pops up out of nowhere. He reduces crime in his country. Let's say it's like a war-torn nation, or it's not a war-torn nation, but it might as well be. It's the highest, murder in the Western murder rate in the Western Hemisphere, despite not having an actual war. More people are dying there than in active war zones across the ocean. And he solves problems overnight. We would look at a guy like that and turn him into a villain and compare him to Hitler, right?
Yeah. Or even...
Or Donald Trump. And that's what the UK is afraid of, frankly, is a leader that will actually have the people behind him. And so it's the last thing that in the post-war consensus you want. Any leader that says, I care about my people, screw the international community, America first. Do you remember... like back in 2014 or 2016, when America First became a campaign slogan, 2015, people instantly compared that to Hitler and Germany, right? So the hierarchy are a bunch of kind of nameless, faceless.
And that's a trend with liberalism. Liberalism likes faceless leadership. Whereas anything on the right wing does not. We actually like, this is our, monarchy. This is a king, having someone who's a defined leader is good and apparently a right wing trait, whereas the left wing prefers shadow government.
Dude, the fact that in Davos, the richest 1% of the world, the richest 1% of the 1% get together in some kind of unofficial capacity and make legitimate rules and regulations that plot out the lives, that plot a course for the agenda of entire nations, despite the fact that they're not even elected. Incredible control in one room. You've got organizations like the Federal Reserve that have more power than whole countries. I think at a certain point, you'd sit back and say, did we really get rid of the dictators in World War II? Or did we just replace the dictators we know with the dictators we don't
know? There's the whole axiom from the American Revolution, why trade one tyrant, 1,000 miles away for 1,000 tyrants 1 mile away? And that's kind of actually analogous to what happened.
Is the proletariat in the world any better off today than they were in 1940? And I'd say, of course not. As you brought up Brexit, that's a perfect example, because you have the will of the people saying, do this. And it was like,
that was an upset too. Like they shocked.
At a certain point, you're like, you guys voted. What's the, Well, what's happening? The bureaucratic state, where the real power is dragging their feet, just looking at the British people going, no, we're not doing what you tell us to do. Forget you. Right? Like, so anyways, they're kind of your priestly class. You've got heresy and anathema, which I alluded to before, certain things that you just absolutely cannot say, and I don't want to necessarily beat the horse on that, but it is there are excommunicable offenses,
and they're usually defined by the ADL, which, you know, just
if you were to say something like, you know, I don't believe in a religious ethno state in Palestine, you're not allowed to say that. You can say that about the United States. You could say, I don't believe in Christians having a religious ethno state.
Why is Israel the exception?
You can't say that about the Jewish people.
So why are they the exception?
What?
Is it just because of, you know, that's definitely critical to the post-war consensus, because there, you know, literally was a post-war consensus. We have to create Israel. We have to decolonize the Middle East, but in some ways we're going to make them the colonizers of the Middle East. And yet they get to be a nation, but no one else does. Or no civil...
You mean a nation by the actual definition of nation.
They get to be a blood and a soil, but no one else gets to be that.
There's so many exceptions with Israel. Like everywhere else in the world, it's all about the power of the indigenous people. You're from there. So in 1948... we took a nation comprised 99% of Europeans and Westerners, and then put them in Palestine and said the indigenous people don't matter at all. I mean, there's so many exceptions. But anyways, the next one I'd say would be sacred history. So just like as Christians, we tell the Christmas story. Right. So before my family opens presents every year, we read Luke 2. We've got our sacred history. There is this sacred history with the post-war consensus. And so here's what I've noticed when I talk about Nagasaki, when I talk about, I think that when Churchill bombed Dresden and intentionally killed as many civilians as he possibly could, that it set the tone for the rest of the war crimes committed by both sides. And the bombing of Dresden, it was not the first, to be fair, but it was the most important turning point in Western culture, where we threw out Augustine's just war theory altogether and said, killing civilians is fair game.
Yeah.
You've got these things that you can't say, and certain facts that you have to believe in. So as a Christian, especially a conservative like you or me, I don't know how you feel. I would say you have to believe God made the world in 6 days. And I know that I'm sure you have listeners that disagree with that. I think that it is very important, more important than what most Christians understand, to believe in a literal creation account. I would say you have to believe in the virgin birth, because these things, if you can't take God's word that he made the world the way he said he did, why would you take his word on matters like, you know, salvation and soteriology? If you don't believe Jesus was born of a virgin, why would you believe that he was raised from the dead? But there are all these facts maybe that there wouldn't even be disagreement on at all. Like, if we're a Christian, you believe Jesus rose again from the dead, right? So if you think that was a metaphor, almost every Christian would say, you're out. You disagree with that fact. Jesus bodily rose from the dead. And that's all there is to it. If you don't like that, you are a legit heretic. Get out. We can disagree, maybe, on some finer points of doctrine. Or maybe you don't really think Jonah was swallowed by the whale. I may not anathematize you, but we've got some facts we have to all agree on. period. And it's really interesting that those things exist regarding World War II. And of course, one of those is the Holocaust. And it's weird the facts that are required. It's not enough. It's really weird. It's not enough to believe in the Holocaust. It's not enough to believe that Hitler murdered a lot of Jews in the Holocaust. You have to believe that 6 million Jews died in extermination camps. Or else you're a Holocaust denier. I think
the reason why it's six is because that's like the holy number for modern Jews. You know, six is like their holy number. You know, it's on their...
I don't know about that.
Well, it's a star of reference, has 6 points and stuff like that. So I think it's like there's, you know, something there to it. If it was 7 million in actual, it'd still they'd still say six.
6 million was a number given in 1954. It was initially a spread of 4.5 to 6 million. But if you were to say, I think 5,999,000 Jews died in the Holocaust in extermination camps, you'd have people call you a Holocaust denier. You're not allowed to deviate from that.
Right. If you said what is the lowest number of deaths that could have happened that I could believe happened and not be a denier, Holocaust denier? Like, you know, what is that number? And, you know, no one really, there's not really a, yeah.
That's right. And I'm not saying for the record that I don't believe 6 million Jews died in the Holocaust. I'm saying it's really weird that it's that specific. Yeah, if you said
4 million.
And what I think it is, I think it's a matter of control. We have established what the number is, or as Doug Wilson would call it, these are the quote unquote received accounts. We've received this. This is the word of God. You will believe
that. That's what Antioch Declaration used that language, right?
Yeah, the Antioch Declaration called it the received accounts. And I was reading that going, this is a guy that I first got into because he was one of the few people disagreeing with the Civil War post-war consensus.
So,
and now he's telling me not to believe in the.
I was going to ask a question about, you know, are there any parallels? Because I kind of, you look at World War II, and to some degree, it's kind of a repeat of the Napoleonic Wars. In the sense, you know, France had this change and the British perpetuated a land war against, you know, the French and got all the European powers to gang up on Napoleon while doing very little other than the Peninsular War. And they fought, you know, in France and then at Waterloo. And, you know, so the British do considerably little in the land war, in the Napoleonic Wars, but they perpetuated the wars against France long enough. You know, that, you know, he would eventually lose at Leipzig and stuff like that. And in World War II, the British kind of ran the same playbook. They perpetuated the war long enough for the continental rival to be defeated, you know, except it cost them everything.
Well, it's like if you understood European history, you would know that the policy for hundreds of years was that Great Britain would be at war with whoever its greatest rival was. And I mean economic, commercial rival, or military. Somebody's getting close to the number of Navy ships produced. There will be a war. It was a constant war. So if you were to say, I don't think Hitler would have invaded Western Europe. I don't think he had that in mind at all. Or if you were to say, as Darryl Cooper did, Churchill was in fact a warmonger. He wanted war more than anything else in life. When you study Winston Churchill from a young man onward, you become convinced that he was the Lindsey Graham of his day. Every single problem that Churchill ever saw, the solution to that problem was war. He loved war. He wanted war. More than anything, I don't believe he was a man of peace. That would make me a heretic for having said it. But other things too. Again, if you don't think that Nagasaki was necessary because 1 million Americans would have died if they invaded the Japanese homeland, you just have to believe. You know, you have to believe these things. or else. But there's also, as with any other religion, there's penance and tithe that you have to pay something financially to prove that you're a good person. So if you are a first world nation, it is your obligation, it is your duty to send your tribute, to send your treasure to other nations, just because. That is your goal, or rather, not goal, that is your duty, that is your responsibility. You must take the treasure from the storehouse collected by your people, and you must send it on in the form of aid. You have to give a certain percentage of your nation's treasure every year to the establishment of standing armies and ongoing military conquest. And you even, I mean, you hear Trump speak of that, talking about the percentage of nation, percentage of GDP that nations are supposed to give. Why? It makes you a good citizen of the world. And there's this concept of being a global citizen. That's all post-war consensus talk. Of course, there is no such thing as a global citizen. That's poppycock. But again, it's like with most religions, I mean, you can't admit certain things are, you know, stupid. There's also sort of an eschatology too, with the post-war consensus. We're working our way towards a utopian transcendence in which humanity itself, the brotherhood of man, transcends to a higher plane of being, a utopian paradise that supposedly we're going to have one day. It's again, John Lennon's Imagine plays in the background. However, there's also an apocalyptic fear that's very palpable with the post-war consensus. And so the...
Yeah, like Putin must be stopped or else. It's a little bit well, of that.
Exactly. And that's where I was going. The idea of preemptive war always being necessary. Putin is going to invade Europe. Which is just, I mean, how dumb is that? Who thinks that's possible? I don't think they could do much more than Ukraine, right? Like
yeah, I think
the mission, like Zelensky stopped them halfway.
Yeah, because Russia invaded, half-cocked. They did a half-cock invasion and then realized, oh, we have to actually mobilize an army.
Well, Putin is Hitler. This is Hitler invading Poland again. Saddam Hussein invades Kuwait, and Saddam Hussein, this is Hitler invading Poland again. And so this is really, I think, to me, it's a huge
but
one.
But Israel's allowed to invade Syria right now. and Turkey yeah, a little bit is allowed to also invade Syria, but
it's one of those exceptions, right, that Israel has. But so I think that preemptive war is tragic. On a personal level, I hate preemptive war so much because I was coming of age during Operation Iraqi Freedom. I was 19 years old when 9/11 happened. I went as a missionary, but through the State Department in a really weird way to Iraq in the middle of the war. I landed in Baghdad in the middle of a war zone, traveled by car to Mosul and to Erbil and up in the mountains in Kurdistan. And I was a big fan of the war. Thought it was absolutely necessary. And then you live through that and you try to stay in touch with people that you met. Let's say fast forward 20 years, you find out that every reason for that war was a lie that they knew was a lie at the time. 1 million innocent people in that country died. 1 million. It led to a massive flare-up of terror all over the world. Things like ISIS have their origin there. And then all of the people that you met who were Christians in Iraq under Saddam Hussein are now dead or having fled.
Yeah, or they're in like Chicago or whatever.
Right? So like, I really hate the concept of preemptive war. But again, because we look at World War II the way we do, everybody we want to kill and the American military industrial complex wants to go to war with, everyone, is Hitler, and we've got to be Churchill, and we got to stop him from invading Poland.
Yeah. And the question is, at what cost? So, and it very well could, you know, it is what seemingly costing America, you know, because we have an empire of sorts, and, you know, we're bankrupting and debasing our own empire, and, you know, we pushed Russia to China and just increased their empire. We're opening the floodgates to India for them. I don't think they're going to be a serious country, but, you know, maybe they can prove me wrong.
Right.
And then all the while kind of being a vassal to the Israeli global interest.
Yeah. To try to summarize my, you know, my concerns, because I mean, we can't talk all night, but there are some issues that I don't think are as important as others, but they're still important to me. So, for example, in the tariffs discussion, it seems like it was just yesterday, everyone was talking about tariffs, and you have all of the Rhino Republicans, all of the guys who were MAGA, who are MAGA now, but they weren't like 6 months ago, you know, upset over Trump's tariffs. Most of that has really quieted down. You know, I'm thinking about Eric Erickson, a blowhard like that guy. I can't stand him, by the way. They're so upset over tariffs because I don't think that necessarily they know, but it's been ingrained to us that the United States is a market for everyone on earth who wants to plunder. They have a right to our market. A tariff is done under the premise our people can buy anything they want from anywhere they want, but you don't have a right to bring it here. You've got to come through us to get our market. We have a good market. You pay us tribute. That's a principle that goes back geopolitically thousands of years.
It's like the most righteous form of taxation. You pay a tribute,
right? So the entire notion of tariffs undergirds nationalism. Listen, we're a nation. We've got walls. We've got borders. You want to come here, you come here by permission. You want to send your crap here to peddle at Walmart, you come through us, you're going to pay it. So in the mindset of the post-war consensus, there's no room for that. None. A nation does not have sovereign rights over Walmart, all right, or over commerce. So on that level, it matters. But then on matters of life and death, and the fact that we are bankrupting this country, we are inflating our currency. Young people in their 20s and 30s probably will not be able to buy a home unless they are very successful or very blessed. I don't want to say lucky. It'll be so much harder for my kid. Like when I bought a place and I'm about to buy another place, like I looked for land and I'm looking now for land that is enough so that all of my children, if they want to, can build the house there one day. Because I'm not gambling. I don't want to make the bet that they're going to be able to buy a piece of property in 20 years because it doesn't look that way.
Yeah, not unless we get mass deportations and some construction and stuff, but
our money is becoming worthless because we're printing it. And the reason why we're printing it is so that we can keep financing forever wars. It's our Defense Department that's absolutely draining us. And the post-war consensus requires ongoing endless war to keep it all up.
And stuff like that.
Basically, you know, USAID. So, and that's the other thing. You have these conservatives complaining about USAID and why, you know, why is it doing all these things? And you're like, that's the CIA paying others to do what the law prevents them from doing, right? This is the post-war consensus that we're complaining about that you are reinforcing. So, I would leave it here. when people complain about history revisionism in the post-war consensus. This is not some History Channel nerds and amateur historians, armchair historians, trying to rethink how many people died in the Holocaust or you know, whether the Blitzkrieg was successful or not. We're not trying to, reimagine various details and historic minutiae for the sheer purpose of the enjoyment of rethinking history. We realize that the battle that we now fight ideologically in so many different ways and on so many different levels goes back directly to what we think happened in World War II, why we think the war happened and what caused it, and what the solutions were so that we don't repeat that same carnage again on such a global scale. So the post-war consensus, it's not about the details of the war per se, but the lessons that we learned.
Yeah.
From those details.
I would say, like, sense. You know, World War One would actually be the war that you'd want to revise the history of, because, like, the bad guys won. Yeah, I thought the Germans were, you know, the Germans were actually the good guys. You know, Austria, Hungary, you know, their guy was whacked. So, you know, them declaring war on Serbia was not unjust.
But... I mean, my gosh, man, unless we stop talking about war and history in terms of the good guys, bad guys. Like, we all need to grow up. I'm seeing respected theologians. I look at somebody like Doug Wilson, who I admire because he's proven himself capable of having deep thoughts about deep subjects, and he's proven himself to be an independent thinker. But on the issue of World War II and the consensus of thought that developed from it, the man absolutely cannot think outside of the box. On any of those subjects that, you know, that we're talking about. And he's unwilling to trace the origin of the ideas that he opposes. Yeah. And so if we are not free to think about history in a way that is open and thoughtful, then we're a slave. Yeah.
And
we're a slave to this consensus that honestly needs to be rethought, and the frankly there's going to be some people that need to die off before we're really able to think about the war rationally and logically without getting emotional.
And I kind of do think, you know, Hitler was, you know, Germany's Napoleonic figure, so maybe in a few decades people will actually, I don't want to say humanize because that has a negative connotation, but see him as like an actual person instead of like a myth.
Let me ask you, because I'm not on X a ton.
Seem like a night owl on X.
A little bit. I post on X after I write an article. You know, I'll throw it out there on X and I'll stick around for a few minutes before I go to bed. But I keep hearing people are talking about Hitler as a Christian prince. Are there people
I don't know enough. So it might be them that's doing that. Like, maybe you can make a case for Mussolini repenting, but I don't, at best, Hitler was a nominal Catholic at best. I don't see the case.
But are you seeing other people say that he was a Christian prince? I just don't know. When I hear the people who hate Christian nationalism say that, I don't know if they're being hyperbolic or if there are actually Christian nationalists arguing that Hitler was a Christian hero. Because I've not seen it, but I don't hang out in that circle.
Yeah, there might be one circle that's doing that, but it's... Again, we're not the people obsessed with Hitler for the most part. You know, it's like the guy that made the Hitler hated Christ guy is obsessed. You know, and some of these anti-Christian nationalists are obsessed. And, you know, the guy was a person whose views changed over the course of time and stuff like that. You know, no different than Napoleon, but again, very similar as far as history and repeating itself in the European theater. So I don't know.
So what do you think? I just want to pick your brain for a second. What do you think are the misconceptions that the anti-XNets have about what you believe in regard to the post-war consensus? Like, if you were going to clear the air and say, you have me all wrong, you know, on what points would that be?
That's tough because it's, on the one hand, it's like, you know, first I would say clearing the air. I think the fall of the British Empire was a bad thing. And World War II killed the British Empire. The final nail in the coffin of the British Empire was when they teamed up with Israel to attack Egypt in 1956, you know, the Suez Crisis. That was like the final nail in the British Empire, was them actually teaming up with Israel. So there's that. You know, fall of the British Empire is bad. Zionism is unbiblical, which they would have a theological disagreement with. But I don't think the air is unclear on that. So,
okay.
And then I guess some people, you know, just going back further, it's like, you know, I don't think the Confederacy was really, you know, I don't think they were really all that bad. Because right. I don't think owning slaves was a sin. It's clearly in scripture that they were allowed to buy slaves and own them.
Did it surprise you? Did it surprise, because it surprised me. Did it surprise you to see the level of outrage at Darryl Cooper for what he said?
Oh, no, I've seen it program.
I had listened to it before the outrage, before, you know, the outrage kind of grew, and it didn't even give me a moment of pause. When he talks about Churchill being the villain, I did not take that to mean that
Hitler was a hero, therefore.
Right. And I also never considered that he wasn't being hyperbolic. He's talking about, you know, driving his friend crazy when he says
stuff. Yeah, because, like, you know, at the end of the day, you know, just take the personality. I kind of just take the personalities out of it for a second, because I'm more interested in the military side of things, the tactical stuff like that. Mm-hmm. And even some of the casus belli for the war, it's like, yeah, I don't, you know, the Germans would have been stupid to have abided by the Treaty of Versailles any longer than they already had. Like, you know, they were right to violate that treaty and say, hey, we're done with this. And I think that
this is, let me ask you one more question. When it comes to Owen Strand and Joel Berry, more Owen, I guess, on Churchill, he strikes me as the loudest wailer and moaner on it. Any criticism of Churchill is just seen with instant, absolute rage. I've never seen anything like it. I'm not exaggerating when I say I think Owen Strand gets madder at criticism of Churchill than blasphemy of Jesus Christ.
Yeah.
I think if Owen were to hear someone blaspheme Jesus, he would probably say, well, that comes from a place of darkness and this person is lost. And we need to remember they're made in the Imago Dei, and it's sad that they said that, but we still want to try to be compassionate. And I think he would have some understanding. And I think that when he hears someone criticize Churchill, it's an anger that comes from kind of the wellspring of his heart. It's guttural, it's instinctual, and he's really mad. What the heck? Where does that go? I mean, maybe it's the idol.
I mean, he did write a book on masculinity, so maybe that has something to do with it. But in all seriousness, it's kind of odd, because wasn't Winston Churchill an atheist? So he wasn't.
No, I did a post this week, I think.
I remember you wrote something on, you know, the Allied powers engaging in the occult, just like the Germans did. I remember you wrote something on that.
Yeah, he was involved in a Druid organization when he was younger. There's a picture of him with regalia, and the people around him are dressed as Druids. And the sources say that was fairly common in British high society, and it wasn't exactly costume parties. It wasn't like just regalia. They were keeping in touch with this history of Druidism in the UK, but they kind of downplay its spiritual significance. But I found that he was involved in occultism much deeper than that. He had a nickname. I think it was the Wizard or something like that. Think of Magic the Gathering minus the card game. And Churchill was involved in this role play LARPing, weird, bizarre thing for super high society in England. Churchill, I mean, I don't see any sign that Churchill was a Christian whatsoever. This is my guess, because I've thought a lot about it. Why does that upset him so much? I'm going to think that the organization that he works for,
which is what nowadays?
What is it?
Something? Dobson. Yeah, that
culture center or something. The only thing I can guess is, as you would suspect, it's funded by probably a small number of very wealthy, very old people. And when very old, very wealthy people are writing checks to keep your absolutely worthless organization alive, I don't know why anyone would pay Owen Strand to do what he does. I mean, you talk about just peeing away your money. Like, what an absolute, what does he do? Like, a public theologian, we used to have them. Public theology only started in the 70s, basically. Martin Marty is the guy who invented this, an LCMS pastor. Churches would pay a theologian to go prophesy to the culture about what God says from the church. Owen Strand gets money from somewhere, an endowment, to lecture the church from the perspective of culture. It's very weird. He preaches to the choir. Why would you pay that guy to preach to Christians? We already have preachers like in our church. My guess is that you can't keep those guys happy without, you know, that's the boomer generation. They probably sat on their dad's knee telling them the stories of, you know, Churchill and Hitler. That's the only thing I can figure, because it's really
weird. I'm going to ask you this question. Are any prominent boomers salvageable? And I know you're not here to boomer hate, as you articulated earlier, but, like, you know, are any names, like, not all boomers are, you know, post-war consensus respecters, but what are your thoughts on, like, getting boomers specifically to unravel on the post-war consensus? What do you think the pathway to that is? Because I'll say this, like, dual loyalty is like the pathway to get the boomer generation to probably relax their
I'd say
enthusiasm for Israel.
I'd say go really easy on them, because my parents, they're definitely boomers, and they're the finest human beings you'll ever meet. But I like, if I say something that I know they would agree with if they could hear me out, I don't want to like beat them with it, right? So we're all familiar with Calvinism cage stage terminology, where you just take Romans 9 and beat somebody over the head with it. You know, you don't want to do that.
I never had that.
So I think that, you know, it's like a person who hears, yeah, we probably shouldn't have nuked a bunch of babies in Nagasaki, for the first time, they may think that's the most radical, insane, like, what are you, Michael Moore now? Mr. Amnesty International, what are you? Like, Sean Penn? You know, like, they may not have any idea where you're coming from. So I'd say be really gentle with them. But, you know, there's nothing broken in the brain of boomers. It's just that, you know, they're 85% of the Fox News audience. That's, you know, to them, Sean Hannity is like a deep thinker, cutting edge, really strong right-wing guy. You know, that's their frame of reference. You know, they're Fox News viewers. You got to take it easy on them. So if you just start sharing with them all this information they've never had access to before, you're going to blow their minds. So just be gentle with them. You know, don't beat your elders. And, you know, it sounds kind of silly to say they're smart. They're as smart as, of course they are. You know, it's just that they've had a lot of brainwashing and they don't have access to alternative media. So you might be telling them something that's completely new. Like, I had always heard that we had to nuke Japan, because if not, we were going to invade Japan and, you know, we would have had 1 million service people die. I had no idea that was total horse crap and absolutely not true. And so you're going to tell them stuff they've not heard before. Go easy on them. You know, they're old. you gotta be nice. They're old.
All right. That's our last question. And thank you, Nobody Special, for the super chat. So anyway, where can they find, where the audience find you? I have yet to link that in the description, but I will. You got a Substack. It's a pretty prominent Substack.
Yeah, Insight to Insight. Check that out. I do about six days a week, sometimes seven. I do 4,000 to 6,000 word articles every single day. I work in finance as my day job, also farm, but I like to write. And so I put that out. Also do Smite Club articles highlighting stories of Christian heroism and courageous Christian men throughout church history. That is available to subscribers of Insight to Insight. I write at Protestia also, but most of that is behind their paywall for their patron supporters. So,
all right. Well, thank you, everybody. Hope you all have a blessed night. Stay based, Christ is King, and we will catch you on the next one.
At KFC, everyday value meets big flavor. That means getting 6 crispy pieces of delicious dark meat drums and thighs, plus 4 biscuits, all for just $10 with our Dine and Dash deal. All that juicy original recipe chicken for only $10 every day. Now that's finger-licking good. Hurry into KFC and taste the deal we're cooking up. Limited time only. Prices and participation may vary. While supplies last, tax, tip, and fees extra. Not available on third-party ordering platforms.
With Robinhood, not only can you trade individual stocks and ETFs, you can also seamlessly buy and sell crypto at low costs. Trade all in one place. Get started now on Robinhood. Trading crypto involves significant risk. Crypto trading is offered through an account with Robinhood Crypto LLC. Robinhood Crypto is licensed to engage in virtual currency business activity by the New York State Department of Financial Services. Crypto held through Robinhood Crypto is not FDIC insured or SIPC protected. Investing involves risk, including loss of principal. Securities trading is offered through an account with Robinhood Financial LLC, member SIPC, a registered broker-dealer.